So, welcome to No Shame, episode 103. So, a man that I wanted to have onto this podcast when we first started off, true leader in my eyes, Mr. Jerry Adams.
Why, who? Paddy, thank you.
You're very welcome, Jerry.
You have a queer setup here.
You like this?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is
a
community within the community, Jerry.
Yeah.
So, what we do here is we kind of let people be able to come home from work and go and just think about the moment rather than going home and thinking about all of the negative stuff that does be going on and the quarrels that you decided to take on for us through so many years. So,
I believe in sport. I think sport's very good, very important. Gives you an outlet, gives you discipline, builds character. You know, so I used to box when I was a kid.
No way.
Yeah.
Had you got good head movement?
No, I was useless.
What weight were you, Jerry? Because you're a big man.
Oh, no, I was only a kid, like I'm talking about when I was 9 or 10 or 11. A cousin of mine, Dominic Bagley, was a good amateur boxer. And he used to take me, it was actually on the Shankill Road. We lived in the Falls Road, so the two roads run parallel to each other in West Belfast. And he was boxing on the YMCA club, and he used to bring me up, and I was living with my granny at the time, and the wisdom was that it would do me no harm to learn how to box. But I never, later on, maybe about 5 or 6 years later, because I only did it for a short while, when my brother Paddy got into a fight, he was being bullied by a big fella in the street. And I went out and tackled him, and instinctively,
Jerry, with the takedowns,
boxing bit came back.
But growing up in like the Falls Road, I spent time in Lanadown as a kid, so yeah. I'd understand Belfast in the idea of like it used to be so much different to Dublin. To me, in Dublin, it was like kids were the ones you had to watch. In our when we went to Belfast, that the community was it. Now it was tough. So I'd say the Falls Road back in your day was tough, Jerry.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't see, and I still don't see, any difference between a housing estate between Tulla and between Ballymun and Ballymurphy, or even way before those estates grew up. I had an uncle and an aunt lived in Dublin, so I used to come to Dublin the first time I came to Dublin was in 1960. County Down won the All-Ireland Football Championship. That was my first time in Dublin, and I got to know Dublin fairly well. They lived in Whitehall, so and this was a time when there were still tenements. This was a time when, you know, people were very, very poor, and when Dublin was more of a town than a city.
Where Tulla would have definitely been out in the
Tulla wasn't even built. If I recollect properly, they were only starting to build Ballymun. Back in Belfast and the Falls Road, the Falls Road was a bit like the Liberties.
Oh,
right. It was terraced houses, small streets, a great community, very poor. Most of the people, the women worked, and the women worked in the mills. My mother worked in the mills. My grannies worked in the mills. The houses had no inside toilet.
So it would have been in lanes?
No, the yard used to use the expression, and some people still use the expression. Older people, I need to go to the yard.
I need to go to the yard. it's hard to die. Them habits don't die.
and there was a cold water tub in the yard. That was the scullery. So my granny reared a big family of mostly sons. She had a couple of girls, and my mother and father, when they were married, lived with different family members until eventually they got a house of their own in Ballymurphy. So I mean, the same thing probably happened to your parents, you know. But people living in the inner city ended up being farmed out.
And it's happening again. I can even see it. Like, I'm 30 now, but like as a kid, I'm looking at and saying, people, them houses were never there when I was a kid. Because even now, like City West is kind of at the spread now, Corbally, all of them things, out into them directions. Sport. When I first met you, I was a kid and my uncle brought me down to Casement Park, and I remember shaking your hand. He brought me to shake your hand and said, "This is Gerry Adams." And yeah, you still had the same amount of hair, but it was jet black at the time, it would have been. But I remember seeing you standing there in such a big man. I remember, and even the people around you, you could see that the respect that they had for you, you know what I mean? And I remember there was like an energy around you, it was like a buzz around you. And then when I met you in the Dáil a few days ago, well, I think it was last week, 2 weeks ago, I had the same kind of feeling of the idea of me. I remember the first time I seen him, the idea of him being, wow, like he's big, you know? And maybe that's the fighter in me.
No, I'm tall. I'm tall, but more than big. But Casement Park was a very important place in the lives of any of us that were Gaels. You know, I started playing, and I was never, I actually played most sports. I'm not saying to any great standard, but I still have a couple of hurdles in the car and a couple of slithers, and I'd still puck a ball about when I get a chance. And played football. Funny enough, we only played street soccer. I never got into
playing on the pitches and stuff.
No, never played, and never really. It's only now, like if Ireland was playing, or you know, or I was watching Geordie Best or Pele or something. But I love Gaelic sports. I love hurling. I think hurling's just such a camogie.
I heard you can launch a ball yourself.
Aye, well, I can still.
I still
puck a slither, yeah. I get slagged all the time. I'm involved marginally now, but I used to be very, very involved in Féile and Phobail. Féile and Phobail was a people's festival, and which started off, you may recall, when the volunteers were killed in Gibraltar.
Yes, I do.
And then at their funerals, the funerals were attacked.
Was that Sean Downs on Anderson's Town?
No, that was a different incident, Paddy. That was
was it related, was it?
No, it was a different incident.
Sorry.
Was that a different incident?
Yeah. I think, were they bringing back the bodies from Gibraltar at the time or something like that? And
No.
That was August.
Her Sean Downs was killed was Martin Galvin.
That's what it was.
Addressed the crowd, and he had been banned from coming to the North. Martin Galvin was a central figure in NORIAD, the Irish American support organization. But anyway, going back to Féile and Phobail, Féile and Phobail was a response to a week of savagery which was inflicted upon the people of West Belfast. And they went in a week from being described, mostly the young people being described as heroes, because they defended the mourners who were attacked at the funeral, two being described as savages because two British soldiers who had been undercover were killed. So it was a dreadful period, and because we were being depicted as the terrorist community, as being savages and so on, and you know, like all of these working class areas, there is great energy in there, there is great creativity, there's a great feeling of community. And there's a great potential to do lots of magnificent things. And West Belfast decided that we would put on a festival. That was going to be our response, to do a Féile as our response.
I remember this.
So all of that developed. And in the middle of it all, we had a Puck Fada. Which I have to claim that I've won on a number of occasions. A long-winded way of boasting. Yeah.
We want to see the medals. Yeah. The next time we want to see the medals. So you mentioned it there, and the idea of it being hard in communities, and especially national security being labelled as terrorists and stuff like that. That had to be, especially with a lot of the collusion that has came out, and on the ground you would have known of this collusion between the British Army and the British government. And the idea of, like, how frustrating it was that to be in that situation where you could kind of know that, but then you're being labelled with this an impossibility that, like, how are people pointing the fingers in? And media wasn't like it is now with social media, so we're in a situation where if you could imagine social media back in that time, people would have got the truth a lot quicker than what we had to wait for. So all these years, how frustrating has that been?
Well, I would tend to take a lot of that fairly philosophically. I mean, I would often argue that the biggest mistake that was made, I mean, leaving aside the partition of the island, which is the biggest mistake for which we're all still paying a price. But when there was a demand for civil rights in the 1960s, rather than give people what were very, very modest reforms, the government, because that's the way the British government behaves, reacted against it and took the side of the unionists and so on. And then when Ian Paisley led protest marches against the civil rights demonstration, and then the Battle of the Bog Side happened. We're back here now in 1969 and 1970. When all of that happened, the biggest single mistake that was made was that the politicians handed over the responsibility to the generals. So you put armies in charge, you put generals in charge. What's their job? Their job is to beat the enemy.
Yeah.
That's their job, defeat the enemy.
At all costs.
And therefore, you have to depict, if you're going to kill somebody and turn them without trial, shoot to kill, if you're going to do those things, then you have to dehumanize the enemy.
Yeah.
And out of that comes the demonization of entire communities.
Would this be like the way people would deal with, say, the way the Americans would have dealt with different nations as they were going in? And we see it happening even more now.
Well, it's what's happening to the Palestinians as we speak now.
Dehumanizing.
It's what happens to working class communities sometimes. That's what Thatcher did with the miners.
Yeah.
You know, so it isn't unique to Ireland. When the English first came to the country, they said that they came to civilize the barbarians. When the Yanks first went into Vietnam, they said it was to defeat communism.
Yeah.
You know, they never say we're in for your oil.
No.
But they're in for strategic reasons. Yeah. We're in for, you know, because you've got minerals or gold or, you know, precious
absolutely
metal.
Absolutely. And they're getting less good at hiding it, I think.
well, so what they do is they disguise their intentions, which are essentially imperialist or colonial intentions. They disguise it with this nonsense of we're going to civilize the barbarians.
Yeah.
Are we going to Christianize the natives? You know, are we bringing God's message to the heathens? You know, it's all.
And if we see films,
rubbish,
these things kind of like you see films like on Vietnam, on invasions and stuff, and it's always there. It's kind of like it makes it okay because the side winning in, it kind of programs the kind of population already in a way.
Well, and then you see out of that then comes like censorship. If you're the enemy and you're able to articulate a position, I'm going to stop you from articulating your position. So people then end up only getting one version of whatever's happening and so on and so forth. And then if you go back to the issue of partition, you know, when the country was divided, there were two very conservative states established. The big focus has been on the Orange state in the north, but this was equally a very mean-spirited conservative state on this part of the island following the treaty. And therefore almost separate developments now. Things have improved here in terms of social issues, but they're still, you know, this state is still one of the wealthiest states in the world.
Classism changes, separates that.
But here you have us. We're sitting here now. There's kids don't have a bed to sleep in.
This is what I'm saying.
So you know, and you have we were around Cambuston earlier on there for Mark Ward, and it's the same story in Ballymurphy as it is here. You know, you go to a house and there's an elderly woman living on her own. This happened to us tonight. Her husband died a year ago. She isn't getting proper support. She isn't getting. She's stuck there on her own.
Yeah.
And you could tell that story 100 times.
And we do. That's what, and that is the good. You mentioned that the idea of being able to say what part of the story, and that's what we do well here, I think, is being trying to translate the story, because it's very easy that it gets lost. You mentioned Ballymurphy there, so I know you spent the time there. So the Ballymurphy massacre had been on, and it's, I think, people going to got to see what really happened in that situation, and that would have been your community, and the news wouldn't have been as big as it was. What was the feelings on the ground when that happened?
Well, I was in Ballymurphy during the period in which all those people were killed. The difference between Ballymurphy and Bloody Sunday is that Bloody Sunday was caught on camera. So there was no denying it.
Yeah.
Ballymurphy happened, and even we didn't know, those of us who lived there, we didn't know maybe for a week later that so many people had been killed. There were 10 people killed directly, and one person died having been assaulted by British troops. He died of a heart attack. But we didn't. We didn't know. And remember, the whole thing was up in the air, you know, and Termit had been brought in by the British. But within a very short period of days, there were stories coming out about her. The people who were being arrested were being tortured and so on. So the story of exactly what happened only started to trickle out. And the situation in the 70s moved so quickly that the big story was internment. It wasn't these 10 or 11 folks that were killed in the Murph, you know?
And we see this happening these days as well. So you do see there's something going on, and all of a sudden this big stupid story comes out on the front of the newspaper, and it could be anything, but in behind that, I find that it's a lot easier, but they're getting worse at the idea of hiding it, you know. So say when the internment, so many bad things are happening at the same time, it's very easy for something to get lost. Would it be right in saying that?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I find, and it's actually very sad at a certain level, there's a transgenerational aspect to this. So some of the people who are most actively fighting justice cases are the grandchildren.
Yeah.
Of the people who were killed. It isn't even the children of the people who were killed. I want to acknowledge that there were people killed by the IRA. There were victims of all the different combatant forces. But Republicans are trying to face up to what they did and are trying to deal with the issue of victims in a just way. For their part, the British refused to do so. You know, the most famous case is the case of Pat Finucane. I mean, when I say famous, I mean the most high profile case. Here's an officer of the court, a human rights lawyer, is killed by the state. There's no doubt at all about that. But the British won't face up to it because, as you mentioned earlier on, collusion was part of an operational policy.
Yeah.
It's as old as war.
Going back to army generals using systems,
it's as old as, you know, you go and you recruit counter gangs, you use agents, you arm them, you give them the intelligence.
Spoilers, kind of, in a way.
Ulsterization was the term they used in the north, where they tried to bring in indigenous forces so that mainstream British forces wouldn't be directly involved. So Pat's case is very, very important because it's the tip of the iceberg to what was...
What actually going on.
Yeah.
Because that's the one you could see.
And that's why the British are still resisting, given the family, the public inquiry that they're asking for.
So I'd have to ask you, so about internment. So internment, obviously people being jailed without committing crime and without trial. Would this have led you to meeting Bobby Sands? Bobby Sands, to myself, I would have literally, from a kid, he would have been probably one of the Irish heroes that I would have studied the most, and I would have sat and thought about, Gerry, about what actually what's going on in the mind, what was going on. I've spent hours thinking of this.
Well, you see, here's the thing, you know, you could have been Bobby Sands.
I know.
Anybody, you know, and Bobby actually, you know, was extraordinary.
Yeah, what was Bobby like, Gerry? Sorry for cutting you.
He wasn't unlike the size that you are. You know, he was a wiry, guy. He was a decent soccer player. He was a very good singer. He played the guitar. I met him in cage 11, and they used to have what there used to be a hut in the yard. We were in a cage, maybe about 120 of us. There were three corrugated iron Nissen huts and a little half hut, and then there was in the middle of the yard a wooden structure, and there were toilets, latrines and showers and stuff. So I used to be writing a bit and reading a bit in the hut, and Bobby used to go there to practice his music. And he wrote, you know, Christy Moore has recorded famously two of the songs, Back Home in Derry and McElhattan. McElhattan's a absolutely brilliant, humorous song about a patching maker. And Back Home in Derry is about being exiled to Australia. So, I mean, both those songs have nearly become part of the tradition. And Bobby also wrote quite a lot of poetry. Now, he was released from prison probably around 1976. And he was only out for a relatively short time, and he was rearrested, and he came back into prison, but this time it was into the hate blocks. Up until that point, the political prisoners had a special status. The British got rid of the special status as part of their criminalisation of the struggle. So people arrested or charged, and they had also a conveyor belt, a whole system of just processing people through interrogation centres, where forced confessions were accepted as
truth,
as evidence, yeah. Right? So that they could beat the shit out of you and you could confess to anything, and that was accepted as evidence. There were no jury courts and so on. And the hate blocks were built probably from about 75 through, and Bobby ended up in the hate blocks. And there were a cadre of people ended up in the hit blocks, mostly young people, just off the streets. Many of them innocent, incidentally, but also there were people like Bobby who had been in prison before, so they knew their way around the system, and they were the sort of backbone. Famously, a guy called Kieran Nugent, who had a red beard, not unlike
from the Falls,
yeah. And Kieran famously said, because they were denying the prisoners the right to education, to free association, but also the right to wear their own clothes. And they give everybody a prison uniform. And Kieran famously said, you'll have to nail it to my back. And that's where the blanket protest and the fear plot came from. There was a version of that with the women. It wasn't just as punitive, and there obviously weren't as many women. There were like hundreds of men in the hit blocks at the head of that protest. As you approach 1980, 1981, like there were men doubled up in cells. There were maybe 500 or 600 living in really, really dreadfully horrific. I ended up in the blocks for a very short time on remand, and because I was a special security prisoner, by a fluke, I got to meet the blanket men because they were taking me out under special conditions, and they were taking the blanket men out under special conditions. So you ended up meeting these guys when you're going out on a visit. Some of them who I knew, and Bobby, when he was in cage 11 with us, and probably before that, had become Gohan, Leifa and Gaeilge. He'd become very, very fluent in Irish. He was a really committed Gaeilgeor, and he learned Irish. So when he went back into the blocks, he started to teach people Irish. And there was a period in the blocks that the prisoners spoke Irish. The prisoners didn't speak English. You just community of people. And they had no writing material. They had no reading material. They had a Bible. You could get religious magazines, but nothing else. That no intellectual stimulation in terms of, you know, books, records, yep. stuff like that. Now, you know, prisoners are very ingenious, so they sneaked in little radios where they could get the news from outside. They started to write on the cell walls. So prisoners were shifted. So I'm in cell 10. I put the Irish language lesson up on the wall. I'm moved. You're moved into my cell.
You learned it.
There's your lesson on the wall. And it went on like that. And they used to entertain themselves at night singing songs. And Bobby used to tell stories and write songs and write poetry. And he also started to send reports out about the conditions. He was the PRO for the blocks. And that's, I mean, what distinguishes Bobby from the rest of them and from the other hunger strikers is that you can actually go and get a Bobby Sands book. You know, you can actually go and read the Bobby Sands poem.
One Day in My Life, that was called.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's an amazing book. Amazing, if anybody hasn't read that, it's a little small, it's One Day, and it's, I remember reading it at about 15 years of age and being blown away by what was actually going on, and then realising what, I used to think, like, what can make men love something so much to go through this?
Well, I often think, as I said earlier on, like it could be you. You know, I mean, a H-block cell would be slightly bigger than the average bathroom. Now, when you go home tonight, you go into your bathroom and you imagine that you're not going to come out of that bathroom until the year 2029.
I couldn't even nearly imagine that.
Just that you're there, you're naked, you've no way of slapping out, you've no toilet facility, and you've none of the other things that we all take for granted, and you're locked up, and you've lost your freedom, and you're not allowed exercise, you're not allowed out and into the yard. So that's where the bond, you know. I meet people. I mean, just last night, or the night before, I was in Belfast, and a friend, a blanket man, his son actually had just taken his own life, and we were just talking about this, and somebody in the company said, "You know, he did 4 years straight on the blanket. Oh, just straight." Just went in the cell, put the blanket around him, just because he wouldn't wear the uniform.
When the campaign was on and Bobby died, was that the reaction when that enough was enough?
Most people of my sort of generation, and it's happening to me now, find it very difficult to talk about the hunger strikes.
I know, I could only imagine. You know, I don't want to bring you too far.
So, there was a special connection between those of us who were on the outside trying to win support and the people who were in the inside. But there was a hunger strike in 1980. It ended at Christmas. There was the basis of a deal. The British, stupidly, took the ending of the hunger strike as a sign of weakness. We and Bobby, to his credit, and the leadership in the prison, tried to make the deal work. The British shafted them, or at least elements within the system shafted them. And Bobby and the rest of them decided to go on another hunger strike. And the difference this time was that Bobby was going to lead the hunger strike. And it was going to be staggered, and we tried to persuade them not to do so. One, we believed that Thatcher wouldn't give in, and two, which was quite pragmatic, we didn't want the whole Republican struggle consumed into a prison struggle, which, you know, was really, you couldn't estimate how it could work out. So, you know, the rest is history. Bobby died, and then the rest of the guys died over that summer in 1981. The women were on the first hunger strike as well. you know, it debated, you were a kid at the time, it debated the society across the island, and it brought it back to what it always has been. And, you know, here we are, like, almost 40 years later, with the Brexit debacle. And what when you peel all that back in terms of Ireland, does that prove? It proves that an English Parliament rules for the English, not for the Irish. What did the hunger strike bring it back to? The age-old battle between people in Ireland who want to be free and those in England who want to retain control over our affairs. And it's those moments in history, at great cost to people involved, to their families, to the men who died on the hunger strike, and to the people who died in the streets. It comes back to that once again. England has no right to be in Ireland. Oh. The people of this island, we can rule ourselves. We should be ruling ourselves. We have the intelligence. Yep. We have the ability. I'm sure we can make peace with the unionists. I'm sure we can deal with the issues that we talked about earlier on, whether it's poverty or homelessness or the unfairness, the inequalities in society. I mean, the people to deal with those issues are the people who live here.
Is it true saying when you say Ireland free shall never be at peace?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
So, as it goes on, so you obviously, you had an assassination attempt in your own life.
Well, I was very lucky, and I was blessed with very incompetent assassins.
Incompetent assassins. That's an amazing way to look at something like that.
I wouldn't be that. I wouldn't be not that I'm.
Would you be religious?
I'm not. The older I get, the more I believe in people, and
yeah,
the more I believe in the goodness of people and the decency of people, and the more I'm amazed by how kind people are and how people are prepared to take a stand and so on. In terms of religion, as we understand it, religious institutions, no, they've run their day. They've had their chance.
I agree in spiritual stuff myself. I'm really good friends with, he actually dropped into my house today, the chaplain down my school. And people can't understand the relationship. It's like a cage fighter and a priest. And they're like,
oh, no, I mean, there are lots of very, very good.
Yeah, and I'm just saying.
Very, very good priests. We buried Father Des Wilson last week, a man of 94, who was an amazing man who did what you were talking about earlier on. He took a stand. He left his position of comfort and power and went to live in Ballymurphy. He went to live in Springhill. He just went and got a council house.
That's true. And to make a stand.
And made it a community house and got involved in jobs creations and education and the arts and all sorts of really good actions and working with people and so on. And, you know, so I mean, I'm not anti-clerical, but if you ask me what I believe in, I do believe in the teachings of Jesus. I think that's fundamentally what the notion of treating people properly, of treating people equally, you know, all of that. I think all of that's to the good, but, you know, it's probably part of the human condition that when people get into power or people get into authority, and if it's not accountable, if it's not under democratic control, then
power takes over in the kind of
way. I think so. It corrupts. Yeah.
Another great man that I would have read of as a kid as well, and probably has me. Cottle King sat here, and when he asked me to run in the election, I was like, do you know what? I did, like, we yeah, and that's where we went with it. But the idea of, people would have been like, what do you know about this? And then I think I shocked people a little bit where I do know a little bit about this. So my grandfather would have taught me very well. He was actually involved in the siege of Javaville in the Congo War at that time. And he would have taught me about African politics, and he would have taught me what was going on and telling me the stories of why they attacked them at that time. And I remember, like, Mandela coming into it. And what was it like to be around the man like Mandela?
Do you know one of my funny memories of, and it's a great tribute to Dublin, when Mandela came to Ireland, it was the same time, and I was here at the time, but myself and our son, Gráid, were here, and the Irish soccer team were returning, and there was a big celebration around the same time as Mandela was coming. There was to be a concert for Mandela, right? And the story goes anyway, I've always thought this was true, but when Mandela was coming down the steps of the plane, there was a huge crowd waiting for the soccer team. And they started to chant, Paul McGrath's da. Paul McGrath's da. So I always thought that was a great tribute to the humour of people here. Mandela was very modest, very welcoming. We Republicans have had a long connection back with the African National Congress and against apartheid, and it was one of my first marches in this city was in 69, was an anti-apartheid march here in Dublin. So there's long connections going back. It was a rugby, if I remember properly.
Yes, that's what it was. Yeah.
Rugby.
I think that was actually started by. I think that was started by. I would say, go on a limb and say John Connors's auntie.
Right.
It was a woman who started it, and I think it was over Dun Stars at the time, wasn't it? Dun Stars.
No, that was a different time, Paddy. That was a different. That was when they refused. That was a brilliant, very brave woman. They refused to sell South African produce.
That's, yeah, so as a boycott, sorry, that's what I'm thinking of, the boycott. And that was an incredible show of power as well, like, from people.
Oh, no, absolutely. It was, and Mandela, quite rightly. Mandela was always, he was very loyal. So it's no accident when he came here, he honoured the Dun store strikers. So these ordinary working women who made this particular stand, 30 or 40 years later, when he comes as president, He
remembered them.
He quite rightly honoured them. He did the same with the Cubans. He did the same with us. He did the same with the Russians. He did the same with the Libyans, people who had stood with them at the height of the apartheid struggle. And he was, I mean, I met him many times. The first time we went to South Africa, the first time we met with him, the British tried to get him not to shake hands with me. They made this an issue, which was ridiculous. I've never, it goes back to this business of demonization and so on.
Yeah.
But they obviously picked the wrong man when they were picking.
That's what I was
when they were picking on Mandela, and he was very welcoming to us, those of us who went to see him. And then, subsequently, many times we met him, and myself and Richard McCauley actually had the great honour, when we were there for his funeral in South Africa, of being asked to go on the Guard of Honour.
I've heard this.
Which was a singular.
But it's a testament to you as a man too.
Well, no, it was a testament to the people in South Africa, to the old comrades in the African National Congress. And Mandela, the thing about Mandela is this, which I think needs to be appreciated. He's very gentle, very committed, very principled, took really important decisions along with his comrades and the leadership. But he was as tough.
Tough as they were.
He was tough. And he couldn't have done what he did if he hadn't been tough. He wouldn't have survived Robben Island and the other incarcerations that he went through. He wouldn't have been able to take on the job that he took on. The decisions they took, it's interesting. We were strategizing here and trying to develop a peace strategy and trying to develop political strategies and so on and so forth. And some of it was quite risky and some of it was totally and absolutely untested. But one of the things that was very good for us, when we met with the ANC leadership, and we compared what we were doing and what they were doing in two different situations, we were more or less doing the same thing.
Same thing.
So that was a confirmation for us.
It's like a byproduct of the environment.
That we were on the right the path in terms of building our own movement and building our own struggle and building peace on our own country.
So as you said, peace day, so the peace process, I think it's a great example of the peace process of both sides coming together and sitting down the way you did, and the concept of like the mind frame when you were approaching that, same to the idea of the huge possibility of being a united Ireland now. And that is the thing, that if we come together, I think it's as apparent now in 1998 when you were sitting down and signing the peace process, to it is now to a vote on the Irish unification. I think we're very similar situations, and I think we could do it again.
Well, the task or the challenge to actually get a peace accord and to get the conflict ended is one particular challenge. But ending conflict or the absence of conflict doesn't mean that you have peace. You know, you need to have justice, yeah. You need to have rights, you need to have systems that work for citizens.
James Connolly said that, wasn't it? There was still really, if even though there's peace there, and there was still really through the landlords and the banks and the oils,
which
would be the same thing.
Yeah. So part of what we argued for in terms of the negotiations for the Good Friday Agreement and so on were about there being no partitionist settlement, there could be no internal arrangement, that's the terminology that was used, and we wanted to have the issue of Irish unity dealt with. Now, we're now back to that issue, and in the meantime, if you ask, you know, why hasn't that issue been raised more vigorously, there's lots of very good explanations for that. One, things need to settle down to a certain degree and systems need to be able to bed in, or as it happens at the moment, not bed in. But also Sinn Féin became very, very busy building Sinn Féin. So we moved into big changes in our party to embrace the new dispensation. So we end up in an assembly at Stormont. We end up in the European Parliament. We end up in councils throughout the island. We end up in the Dáil in increasing numbers. We end up in the European Parliament. Now, that takes a lot of management, skill, resources, capacity, logistics.
Building, development.
Building, all of that. And that has preoccupied the party for quite a long time. And we also, generally speaking, fight an election every year. If you look back over the last 20 years, because we're fighting elections north and south,
yeah, both
we're more or less fighting them annually. So at Brexit is the accelerant.
This is what I was going to ask you. Is Brexit the stepping stone that Michael Collins was talking about?
No, I don't think it's a stepping stone that he was talking about. It is, once again, proof that, and this is very understandable, English Parliament's ruled in English interest and the Irish are just incidental to it. It just isn't in the consciousness of the Theresa Mays of this world or of the David Camerons or of any of the rest of them. So they took decisions around Brexit for very narrow reasons, some of it just awry within the Tory party between...
Yeah.
Farage or whatever his name is and Cameron. So we end up in the collateral damage for that. But that then exposes the partition of the country, because since Good Friday Agreement, while partition still remains and the border still remains, the island has more or less gelled as a single economic unit. So all the previous military trappings that were around the border, but also the tariffs and the different barriers that were put in place, have all been removed. So people, not just those who live in the border counties, but people who are dependent on all Ireland trade, don't want to see the Brexit going through. The people of the north voted against Brexit, and that has been ignored. So it isn't so much that it's a stepping stone, but that it has opened people's eyes to consider what's the best. Is it best to have a return to the border? Is it best to have a situation where trade, which was flowing freely across the island, is stopped? Or is it best to have an all-island version of it? On top of that, the demographics in the north have changed. The unions have lost their electoral majority. The issue of rights, which was being denied by the DUP around Irish language rights or women's reproductive rights or the issue of marriage equality, the issue of a Bill of Rights, all of that has come very, very clearly into focus. That doesn't penetrate into the south. I represent Louth, and my family home is still in Belfast. So the issue of rights is a big issue in the north. It isn't such a big issue here in the south. But the issue of Irish unity, of the prospect of us governing ourselves.
Yes.
You know, what the government needs to do, and there was a very good initiative recently there. It's a citizens' initiative called Ireland's Future, and they had over 1,000 signatures in the Irish Times and in the Irish News of people from all sectors, from business, from the arts, from academia, from sport, from music, saying to the Taoiseach, you need to start planning for the future.
Yes.
Plan for the future. That's all we're asking you to do. Consult with us about planning for the future. We want to be part of it. We don't want to be told by Boris Johnson what our future is going to be. We want to work that out for ourselves. So that's all in the mix at this period. It's going to be a very interesting. Mary Lou MacDonald at the Ardesh of Sinn Féin and Derry said this was a decade of opportunity. And that's what's opening up. 2020 is going to be a decade, the start of a decade of great opportunity.
So in 2030, like this is, we could be looking at the finished product of what has been fought for many, many, many years. Hopefully.
Well, first of all, let me say two things about that. One, Irish unity is no longer an aspiration. Irish unity is a project. It's there. I'm not saying it's around the corner, I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but it is a project. And secondly, we're the first generation ever in the history of Ireland who have a peaceful way to bring about Irish unity.
Yeah.
Bobby Sands didn't have it. Padraig Pearse, James Connolly didn't have it. We have it. We have the right to a referendum, and we have the possibility of winning that referendum. And if that happens, then we're going to see the island united. So that's the opportunity that we have at this time. And the government should be in the driving seat of that opportunity.
I won't keep you much longer, but I don't think I could do a podcast and not come across, and especially you mentioned in Derry there, so I'd have to mention Martin McGuinness himself. For many years would have been a comrade and right hand man.
Well, I wouldn't say he was my right hand man. we were like twin brothers in many of the enterprises that we were involved in. No, Martin was a very remarkable person. He had a very, very strong will. He also. And Derry, I don't know if you're familiar with Derry. Derry's a brilliant place.
Derry twice. For the Millennium Forum. Yeah. I actually fought on the stage where the Ardesh was.
Yeah.
Twice.
Did you win?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, good mark. Well, Derry's like a, you know, Derry's a relatively small town, and it's very open, and it has a very good sense of itself. And a lot of the people, you know, the only thing, Martin McGuinness used to say, the only thing that keeps Derry in the north, he meant in the six counties, was the bridge, because Derry's natural hinterland was into Inishowen, and that's where Martin's people came from.
Okay.
So he was reared, and his summers were spent up in Inishowen, a place called the Ellies, you know, and his mother Peggy, if we landed into Peggy's now, she would feed us like fighting cocks. She was just a very typical country woman who, you know, would be making sure you were well looked after and everything else. And I think a lot of that is what made up Martin's personality. Martin was great with people. I would be a wee bit shyer, but Martin was very sociable, very affable with people. And, you know, he was in government, in a shared government position with Ian Paisley, and it was quite remarkable. And I think that part of what brought that about was, I mean, Martin was nearly even deferential to Ian Paisley. As an older man, he just showed that respect to his elder.
Yeah.
You know, and you could see that if you watch some of the footage, you can see Martin's
being, even when he was getting into EMPs, he was getting sick at that time. Yeah, yeah.
No, and famously, Martin, you know, ended up at his wake and ended up as being very close friends to his wife Eileen. So when Martin died, like, it's part of the uncertainty of life. When he was diagnosed with this particular ailment, which is very, very rare. It was obviously dreadful for him, for his family, for Bernie. I was talking to Bernie just at the weekend there. But it was also for the rest of us who knew him and who worked with him for all those years.
He had such an ability to show the world that, like, people can come together no matter what the history is. Yeah. I have to ask you, do you miss him?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
As a friend and a comrade and a brother, Ireland misses him.
Well, I was very moved by the period after his death, the number of people who stopped me and who missed Martin McGuinness. They never met him, but he was on television continuously. He was there in the front line when there was trouble, trying to keep peace, trying to calm things. He was there arguing the toss. He was there during the peace process. The number of people who would have stopped me and say that they were talking about me, Aunt Martin, you were in my life since I was a child. This would have been people in their 40s.
Same as me, know, as well.
So Martin was, he's very missed by all of us, very, very missed by all of us.
Two more questions and I'm finished, which, all right? I won't ask any more. First one, the cookbook. Give us a dish. What's your favourite dish in the cookbook? The peas process of me and myself with my album.
Well, it's hard to pick out. You see, the cookbook. Well, first of all, for your listeners, when we were up doing the talks, one of our friends, a guy called Ted Hurl, he was part of our negotiating team. What I brought up, you know, because you'd be in long talks and there'd be no canteen or other facilities. Maybe what I brought up a couple of flasks of soup and some bread. And then after a while, he would have been bringing up, you know, salads and so on and so forth. And then it got into another guy called Padraig Wilson. He would have made some milchugi, some desserts. And so we ended up having a fairly decent bit of food. So I just wanted to tell that story, but also to recreate some of the meals that these people cooked for us. They actually fed the peace process in many ways. So the book's a wee bit of a wee bit of fun. But it's also trying to demystify that, you know.
Yes, of course, I know what you mean.
So these are good people and decent cooks, and you know, Martin McGuinness and Gerry Kelly actually put on weight during the process. So what's my favourite? Some of the soups, some of Ted's soups, some of the bean soups would be my favorite, but I love food. I mean, I'd eat anything. And
there's one in it called the long quiche.
Yes, well that's all just mess. And like,
it was a great idea, and I think it's good to see humor like that, especially after so much tragedy and so much hurt as well along the year. So it is great to see that. The last question I have to ask you: could we ever see Gerry running for the president of Ireland?
No.
No.
It's very interesting that you would ask me that, because that's the question that I'm asked quite often. And I never had ever any intention, don't have any intention, and never will have any intention of running for that position, but yet the media still raise it. So I'm representing Louth. I was first elected in 1982, represented West Belfast for a long time, represent Louth. I'm very grateful to the people who elected me in West Belfast and now in County Louth. When Leo and Micheál Martin decide to call an election, that's my public representation finished.
That's when you're going to throw your gloves in the ring, as we used to say.
I'll give you a fair dig, Paddy.
You'll give me a fair dig. I say you would, Jerry, I have to say, it was an absolute pleasure, and it was an honour.
And thanks for your book. I heard you talking about this book, Hooligan, and I was very taken, the story about your father that you just retold. So I'm looking forward to reading this, and thank you very much.
My grandfather, absolutely, he was a true man to me. To see you to listen to that story and get back to me and let me know, I think you will understand why I am where I am, and hopefully in years to come I can do a lot for the party of Sinn Féin. And I was just asking that president question so I made sure there's no competition.
Good man.
There's no shame, episode 103 with the legend that is Jerry Adams.
Good man, Paddy. Go to Margaret, Carla. Slán lad. Thank you, Paddy.